There was no collusion at all. No collusion.
Well, he was a lawyer for me for one of many. They always say the lawyer, and then they like to add the fixer. Well, I don't know if he's a fixer.
So Rudy knows it's a witch hunt. He started yesterday. He'll get his facts straight.
I understood Michael Cohen very well. Turned out he wasn't a very good lawyer, frankly.
Says who?
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about all of President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host. He's a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor, and he blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh. Greetings from sunny Washington, D.C.
Yeah, so you've gone there to cover the impeachment trial. We really appreciate you doing that for us.
Is that going on? No, I was actually here on business and figured that, I might as well check out this impeachment thing as long as I'm here.
Yes, so actually I misspoke. It's not the impeachment trial. It's just the vote on the impeachment, the indictment, essentially. And as listeners are hearing this, President Trump may have already been impeached. As we tape on Wednesday morning, the House is opening its debate over impeachment articles, and nearly the entire Democratic caucus has committed to voting yes, which should ensure passage. The president is unhappy. He sent a 6-page letter to Nancy Pelosi telling her why impeachment is so wrong and bad. This is nothing more than an illegal, partisan attempted coup that will, based on recent sentiment, badly fail at the voting booth, unquote. It's just one excerpt from the letter. Ken, did this letter contain any legal arguments?
No, it was more of a strung-together series of Trump tweets, prolonged, emotive expression of his angst about this whole thing. It was really every argument he's made, every argument that people on his side have made, reduced to basically to press conference form or rally form and stuck into a 6-page letter.
So one thing that he says in here, in addition to, essentially political arguments like, this is unpopular and you're going to get punished at the polls and you're trying to overturn an election, and you're just mad because I won when I was supposed to lose. He says that the impeachment articles do not allege a crime. And so I guess I have two questions about that. One is whether it's true and the other is whether it would matter even if it was true.
It's not really true and it doesn't matter. So he's right that the impeachment articles don't expressly suggest that he committed a specific federal crime. But as many people pointed out, including a subsequent report by the Judiciary Committee, the acts described in the articles could be federal crimes, even if they're not expressly labeled that way. Moreover, it does not need to be a specific federal crime for it to be impeachable. That's very clear from the language of the impeachment clause and from the background of what the framers thought about it and what they were intending in putting together the clause.
Yeah, I think it's important to note, at the founding of the country, there were very few statutory federal crimes. Most crime most crime continues to be a matter for state government. And so it would have been very strange at the time of the founding to have suggested that impeachment had to be over statutory crimes. What did you make of that document from the Judiciary Committee laying out an argument about, what specific federal statutory crimes the president might have committed? If you're going to make that argument, why not put it directly in the articles of impeachment?
Well, it seemed to me to be a somewhat clever way to separate out political arguments to a separate place where they couldn't be used to derail the impeachment. So as we talked about last week, the articles of impeachment are clearly designed to be minimalist and to avoid technical arguments like, you're charging him with bribery, but he didn't have the requisite intent under federal law, something like that. But as you pointed out, that means that there's not federal crimes expressly talked about in those articles of impeachment. So what this does is it lets them separate it out from the impeachment vote, remove that discussion of federal law, which can be very convoluted, from the discussion of impeachment, but still make the political point that, yes, these are also crimes.
There were some news reports saying that White House lawyers were barely involved in drafting this letter that Trump sent, that it was put together largely by political aides such as Stephen Miller. Does the letter do anything that harms his legal position? Because one thing those reports said was the lawyers were sort of irritated about being cut out of the process.
Well, I don't know that his legal position, if he really has one or if it can be harmed. I mean, his legal position is that you don't have 2/3 of the senators, and so you can never convict me in the Senate. Beyond that, his position that these are not impeachable things, that abuse of power isn't a thing, that obstruction of justice isn't a thing, those he refers to in his letter and probably doesn't shoot himself in the foot doing so. It's a very political document as opposed to a legal document, so it's not surprising that the lawyers were not involved.
Neil Katyal, who's a professor at Georgetown University Law School, tweeted saying that the letter guts Donald Trump's claim to avoid testifying under oath. I was trying to figure out what he meant by that. Is it that, like, you know, if there were a situation in the future where Donald Trump wanted to take the Fifth Amendment, say, if, you know, and we'll talk about this in a moment, if we got into a situation where he could be testifying before the Senate in his own trial, is it that you can't take the Fifth Amendment, you can't assert your Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination if you're also insisting that you haven't even been accused of a crime?
Well, no, it's more, I think he was suggesting that somehow he had committed himself to talking and therefore couldn't change his mind and take the Fifth. But I don't think that's right. I think that under the general rules that apply to the Fifth Amendment, this letter is not occurring in the same proceeding as the Senate trial. So it would not prevent him from taking the Fifth in the Senate trial. To the extent he is talking about how if he denies there's a crime, there can't be a Fifth Amendment assertion, that's not right either, because the question is not whether the prosecutors are right, but whether your testimony might provide them with a link in the chain of what they're claiming that you did. So, no, I don't think that it would waive any Fifth Amendment rights, which, of course, the scope of which are going to be determined by the Senate and by the Chief Justice anyway.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has provided more clarity on how he might run a Senate trial of the president. McConnell intends to have the House impeachment managers present their case. The president's lawyers will make their own case. Then the senators will get to ask questions and deliberate, but they don't intend to call any witnesses. Now, this sounds to me like it's actually somewhat similar to at least the initial approach that the Senate took when it was trying Bill Clinton in 1999. So when Democrats say that, you know, that this is an unreasonable approach to how to conduct a trial, it does appear to have at least that precedent, right?
It does. It's very similar to the Clinton trial, and there were discussions and disputes in the course of the Clinton Senate trial about how to handle it. They did take witness testimony in the sense that they did private depositions of some of the main players, but nothing that would resemble trial testimony as we would normally see it in court. So if they did handle it this way, not take any live witnesses in front of the full Senate or even in front of a committee, and maybe permit a few depositions, private examinations of people, that would be very parallel to what they did with Clinton.
And I think it's worth noting they decided midway through the trial process with Clinton that they would conduct those depositions, and that was a part of a negotiation. We got a note from a listener objecting to my repeated characterization of Clinton's trial as a 5-week trial. It did take 5 weeks from the opening of the trial to the rendering of a verdict, but they spent much of that time in the middle arguing over how to conduct a trial. They made this decision midway that they would take certain depositions. They had to pause in order for those to be conducted, but it sort of was like more like 2 or 3 weeks that contained actual trial content. So if you're trying to plan around, you know, how long is this trial going to take, McConnell's idea that this might be something that you could dispose of within a couple of weeks also seems to have precedent from that.
Certainly. And you have to keep in mind that those are Senate weeks, so it's not as if they're cram-packed with content every day. This is something where, you know, something might happen for a couple of hours on a day and then maybe for an hour the next day and so on. But if they really wanted to devote their full attention to it, which they rarely do, you could finish it fairly quickly and get as much done.
In fairness, the Senate does have other business to conduct, and that's part of why the trial takes such a long time for relatively small amounts of content. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader in the Senate, has been talking about his displeasure with this set of rules this potential set of rules for governing a trial and saying that he intends to force votes on calling certain witnesses. And so one question people have is, how much control does Mitch McConnell really have over the manner in which this trial is conducted? I mean, Chief Justice Justice John Roberts will preside over it. I gather you can, the senators can appeal rulings from the chair. And so the majority at least is therefore in theory in charge. But he'd really have to hold all those Republicans together, not just on a final verdict, but on individual components of decisions about how to govern a trial if he wants to force his way and, for example, block Chuck Schumer from having witnesses called, right?
Yeah, it just depends on how willing he is to get straight up and down votes with the Republicans supporting him. Now, technically, the Senate needs a supermajority to change existing Senate rules, but they can overturn any particular ruling based on a majority. So that makes it fairly easy to navigate around rules. There are the rulings of the Chief Justice in his capacity of presiding over the impeachment, but those rulings can be overcome by a majority vote of the Senate. So it's really about how much McConnell wants to have these open votes on procedure and to what extent that helps or hurts.
Lawrence Tribe, the professor at Harvard Law School, says that because Mitch McConnell does not intend to hold a wide-ranging trial with a substantial number of witnesses, he says Democrats should pass the articles of impeachment but then refuse to actually transmit them to the Senate until the Senate agrees to better, more comprehensive trial rules that will involve more fact-finding. Now, this suggestion, which has been gaining a certain amount of traction, at least among, you know, very online resistance people, and is at least being talked about in Washington, although I think Nancy Pelosi has no intention of listening to Professor Tribe's suggestion, it doesn't make any sense to me at all. It doesn't make sense as a matter of strategy, and it also doesn't make sense as a matter of constitutional law. Now, first of all, the law matter, I mean, the Speaker can't just like refuse to send out duly passed legislation, right? That would be usurping the power of the majority of the House. If the, you know, I realize the Speaker tends to have strong operational control of the House, but you can have circumstances in which something passes the House that the Speaker didn't like. If the Speaker could just say, well, I'm not sending it on, then that would basically mean that the House didn't have its own independent authority.
Right. And in particular, I believe that there are rules that govern here that require an impeachment to be promptly transmitted. So it doesn't seem that it's something that the Speaker just could do by fiat. Although, again, the Democrats hold the House. They could take votes. They could decide to do it that way. But it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's sort of a, it sounds terrible when you're doing articles of impeachment that accuse the president of not following the law and of being a power unto himself. And it's not really clear to me how it helps politically either. It just seems like they're avoiding the fight. And, you know, I understand how the Democrats are upset that the Senate's almost certainly going to vote to acquit. And by almost certainly, I mean 99.99. But sometimes you go into no-win scenarios, and I think that they need to just send it there as their best belief of impeachment being appropriate. And, you know, if the Senate says no, that's on them.
Yeah, I don't understand what the leverage here is supposed to be at all. If they said to McConnell, well, you know, we're not going to let you hold this trial until you have rules that we like, wouldn't McConnell just be like, okay, then we won't try the president? I mean, you know, the thing I see on Twitter is people saying, well, then the president doesn't get to say he was exonerated in the Senate trial, which, you know, if you look at the president's letter, it doesn't look like he's eager to be put on trial for this stuff. And, you know, it's not like any set of facts is going to stop the president from saying that he's been exonerated in some manner or another. So I don't get this idea at all. A better strategic idea that I've heard from some people is that House Democrats should send up former Republican Justin Amash, who now sits as an independent member, as an impeachment manager. Now, we'll remember we talked a couple of weeks ago about this Judiciary Committee hearing with all the left-leaning law professors and sort of the missed opportunity to present the case that, you know, actually a lot of people in the center or on the right have objections to the president's behavior, believe it was impeachable. This would be an opportunity to send up someone who was until recently a Republican to make the case that the president should be removed from office.
Right. And he's a very vocal critic of Trump and an eloquent one. He has continued to do this throughout the last few months, and it would certainly give some credibility to the concept that this is not a purely Democratic affair. The problem is, I guess, that the nature of Trump support is that anyone who is not, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid is just as good as a Democrat. So I don't know who you persuade with this approach. I think that the people who would be impressed that it's someone who was a Republican doing it, are already going to be persuaded by the case for impeachment. I don't see that it really changes any minds.
Well, I mean, you have polling in the single digits among Republicans saying that they support impeachment, which is more than zero. And, you know, something that helps you peel off, you know, another, you know, percentage or even fraction of a percentage point of the president's support, I think, is something that can matter at the margin in swing states. So, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into political strategy here, but I think that, you know, the standard doesn't have to be that it's going to convince a lot of Republicans. Convincing even a few Republicans could be quite valuable. We've been talking about a number of cases that have been heading toward the Supreme Court about whether people associated with the president should have to comply with subpoenas for documents about him and his businesses, also about whether his advisors could be compelled to testify in various venues. It was unclear whether the court would take these cases, but now they have decided to do so. What do you make of that?
Well, there are a couple of ways you could take it. Historically, the Supreme Court has taken these presidential powers cases and it has not wound up going well for the president. In both the Nixon and Clinton cases, the court took the case but ultimately ruled that there were limits on the president's power. The president was not above the law and had to respond to legal process. In both cases, the court also put some limits on that and made it put the president in a preferred position, let's say, for raising objections and made it clear the president's not the same as just anyone off the street. But ultimately, it required the president to comply with legal process. So there are two ways to look at this. One is that this just signifies that, as before, the court's likely to continue with the idea that the president's not above the law and, you know, perhaps put some limits on the ability to seek these sorts of documents, but not put the president above the law. The more alarming interpretation is that the president has the votes to uphold some of his arguments, even some of his more extreme arguments, like in the case of the New York grand jury, where the president's position has been more or less that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and so long as he's in office, he can't even be investigated for it. One hopes that the Supreme Court would never go that far, but then again, we're not living in a normal time.
Normally, one reason the Supreme Court would take a case would be that there is a circuit split, that, you know, the 11th Circuit has said that something is okay, but the 9th Circuit has said, no, it's not. And so that's not the situation we have here. When you have situations like this where the courts are basically in agreement with each other across various regions about what the rules should be, if the court's taking those cases, I think we would normally assume that that was a strong signal that the court intended to reverse their decisions, that the reason that the court was going to spend time on this issue was that there had been an error in lower courts that needed correcting. But I guess what you're saying about presidential powers cases is that these are either of such importance or of such, you know, centrality to the structure of the Constitution or something, that the court would tend to take these cases even when neither of those two conditions applies?
Yes, and that you can't read the signals exactly the same way. We've talked for a while about how conservative in Supreme Court terms does not mean the same as conservative in political terms, and how justices who are appointed by Republicans may well jealously guard some of the limitations on presidential power and agree with cases like Nixon and Clinton that put limits on that power. So it's different than normal cases, and as are just about all these cases about Trump. They're just not normal. They exist outside the normal run of litigation. So I think that if it were anything else, any other litigant, you would definitely see the court accepting all these three as a sign that was very good for the person appealing to the Supreme Court. But I don't think you can as confidently make that call here. We may wind up with some sort of split decision where the court permits a criminal investigation but puts limits on the congressional power to subpoena these documents. We may wind up with a very divided court, 5-4, on what the president's powers would be, which is very different than the Nixon and Clinton cases.
When should we expect a decision?
By June. So the Supreme Court's term ends in late June, and so they've scheduled argument in these cases in March, and so we should see opinions by June, if not sooner.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about our favorite, Rudy Giuliani. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So, Rudy Giuliani. Rudy has been taking credit for getting Marie Yovanovitch removed as ambassador to Ukraine. He says he believes she was causing trouble with efforts to get visas for people who had information about so-called Ukraine collusion or whatever to come to the U.S. and tell their stories. Now, setting aside the unlikelihood that the ambassador was actually interfering in those sorts of consular actions, people have responded to this by saying, you know, what the fuck is Rudy doing here? Why is he out in public doing something that conceivably looks like admitting to crimes? But it seems to me this could actually be part of a legal defense for Rudy, because a key question is whether he's going to be indicted for violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Did he act on behalf of foreign clients to, for example, seek the removal of the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine without registering with the federal government as a foreign agent? And so when Rudy is out there saying that he intervened in this issue because she was interfering with Donald Trump's political prerogatives, that seems like a claim that he wasn't a foreign agent, that he did this on Trump's behalf and therefore wasn't a FARA violation. Am I reading this right? Is Giuliani doing something like smarter here from a legal strategy perspective than it would look like?
Well, the mere fact that you're suggesting an elaborate, complex legal strategy, I think, calls into question whether it's accurately predicting what Rudy Giuliani is doing. But yes, the problem is he's kind of, it's sort of a pick your crime type situation, so that there are potential theories of criminality no matter what his motivations were. But yes, if he's most worried about the foreign agent stuff, then he might be pushing back and saying this was all only ever for Donald Trump, my life for Donald Trump, and I didn't really do it on behalf of any Ukrainians. Yes, he's brutally criticized the former ambassador, called her corrupt on television without any specifics. One assumes that just means opposing the administration. And he certainly seems not to be taking the standard advice about this type of situation, which is not to go on TV and talk about what you did and why you did it when you're under federal investigation.
His former associate, Lev Parnas, is still not in jail. He's out on bail. Federal prosecutors tried to have him jailed pending his trial for campaign finance violations because they said Parnas willfully concealed financial resources from them, that Parnas' wife had received $1 million from Ukrainian oligarch Dmytro Fertash, and that Parnas didn't disclose that in the process where he was letting them know about his financial resources as they determined what his bail conditions would be so that he wouldn't flee the country. Prosecutors didn't win this argument. I guess Judge Paul Otkin decided that he can still stay out of jail pending trial.
Right. The judge felt that the statements that were made that referred to that payment were not sufficiently deceptive or clearly enough intentionally deceptive to warrant yanking his bail. But one gets the sense that he's going to be on a shorter leash now. But the payments themselves are it's quite remarkable. I mean, you've got $1 million coming from a Ukrainian oligarch who is currently under indictment in the United States and is resisting extradition in Austria, which I guess if you have to resist extradition someplace, Vienna is a pretty nice place to do that. So it is extremely skeevy. I think that the prosecutors are licking their chops over the prospect of what they can do with this in the case, not only against Parnas, but against Giuliani, Parnas's leash holder.
But so what would Parnas has so far been charged with these campaign finance violations, but the thinking is that prosecutors are developing a broader case, not just they're investigating Giuliani, but that they could conceivably indict Parnas and Fruman for more things? What would they be looking at?
They may be looking into more foreign agent issues. And certainly the fact that someone from a foreign country is sending you $1 million tends to support the concept that you're an agent for foreign interests.
Especially when they're sending you that money and you've been going all around the U.S. conducting political activities, trying to influence the government that appear to align with that foreign person's financial interests.
Exactly. But who knows? Maybe his wife is just really nice and, you know, it's a gift.
So then there are some other cases that are drawing to a close. Rick Gates, who was sort of the mini-me to Paul Manafort, has been sentenced to 45 days in jail to be served on weekends. His case, like many of these other cases, was before Judge Amy Berman Jackson. Prosecutors had recommended probation. Does it make sense to you that he got, you know, this little bit of jail time?
It does. It's a very lenient sentence, even with the 45 days, given what he was facing, given the volume of money that was involved in some of the counts that he pled to. But this shows you the power of cooperation and how much credit you can get when you testify repeatedly for the government. And this is why it's important to be that fabled first person in the door. So Gates testified successfully and fairly convincingly, despite his quirks. And he got what he wanted. He got a recommendation from the government that they wouldn't oppose no custody. And he got 45 days on weekends when he could have easily done years. So this is why people cooperate, to get exactly this type of result.
Yeah, we said he cooperated by testifying in two trials. I'd forgotten, it was actually three. In addition to Paul Manafort and Roger Stone, he also testified against Greg Craig, who was the Obama White House counsel who was tried and acquitted for a FARA violation related to Ukraine. So Gates went 2 for 3 there on his cooperating testimony. Another thing we learned in this sentencing process was that there had been an offer of financial assistance to Gates if he had not cooperated, to help him with his legal defense. And I gather we learned from prosecutors during the sentencing hearing that that offer was from Paul Manafort. And this is a question I've asked about this sort of thing previously. Was that necessarily improper? I mean, there can be valid reasons to assist your co-defendants with their legal defense. I mean, if you're concerned, for example, that they will, you know, falsely testify against you if they feel that they can't afford their legal defense.
Well, sure. And let's be frank, you cannot defend against the United States in federal court on a complicated white-collar case unless you have a vast amount of money. Because it's just ridiculously expensive. So offering to fund someone's legal defense is not itself obstruction of justice. If there were some sort of offer that specified what he would have to say or do, or that, you know, focused on him not revealing something as opposed to just him defending the case, that could cross into obstruction.
Speaking of Paul Manafort, he has been hospitalized for a cardiac event, and his lawyer has been complaining to the press. I guess Manafort was hospitalized on Thursday of last week, and for days, the lawyer says that he and Manafort's family had been unable to get information out of the Bureau of Prisons about his condition and his location. Is that unusual?
Not even a little. It's a black hole, and once your client is someplace, they've been designated to some facility where they're going to serve their sentence, it is not at all unusual to have great deal of difficulty getting information about what's going on with them, and even when something life-threatening is going on with them. It is not the situation you'd want to be in with health problems. I mean, you're basically, your health care is being taken care of by the people who let Epstein hang himself in a cell. So it's not a good position to be in, and lawyers are constantly frustrated at not being able to find out what's going on with their client, why their client isn't responding to letters, what their health is, what treatment they're getting, and so forth.
Because I feel like people have looked somewhat askance at this. I mean, Manafort showed up in a wheelchair some months ago to a court hearing. And I think people have assumed that, you know, if Manafort is going for an eventual pardon or commutation of his sentence, that part of the argument for why to let him out of prison before he's due to be released in 2024 would be some compassionate thing about his health condition and his age and such. But I guess, of course, that doesn't mean that he's not actually sick.
It doesn't. And so, yes, absolutely, he could be malingering and vying for a pardon or something like that. But apparently he was transferred to a hospital, and generally he would have to be fairly seriously sick to get that level of care.
Finally, let's talk about Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn is going to be sentenced finally next month. He had filed this motion making all of these arguments about why he'd been treated so unfairly by the government and why his case should be dismissed. And Judge Emmett Sullivan, in a very long order, rejected every single one of Flynn's arguments, as far as I can tell, really did not seem to care for this argument after Flynn had pleaded guilty that, in fact, the charges that he pleaded guilty to should be dismissed. And he also even accused Flynn's lawyer, of Sidney Powell, of breaching the rules of ethics by plagiarizing part of her brief.
Yes, it was a brutal order, and it really demonstrated the risks that Flynn took by taking this particular approach, by spinning these tales of misconduct and how they necessarily led to his prosecution, and by really playing to Trump in request for a pardon as opposed to making an appeal to the judge for the most lenient sentence. The judge 100% rejected everything Flynn was saying. Not surprising, because a lot of it was just crazy and was very critical. Now, there's a fair amount of dissent about whether or not it's inappropriate in a legal brief to copy arguments from another legal brief, but all that matters is that the judge is upset, and that's not a good place to be with your sentencing coming up. We don't know what the judge will do, but I think it's highly likely that Flynn has talked himself and argued himself away from a probationary sentence into a custodial sentence, possibly of a number of months.
And we'll find that out next month?
Yes. And I think we can expect that hearing to be quite a scorcher, as hearings before this judge have been in the past, particularly since he is so genuinely upset that Flynn, who has pled guilty and then reaffirmed his guilt, is now waffling on his guilt.
When you say a number of months, can you make a more specific prediction there so that we can go back and hold you accountable once the number comes down?
You know, I got Michael Cohen right. I'm just planning on cruising on that forever. But it would not surprise me for him to get 3 to 6 months, which would be very unusual normally for a cooperator who pleads guilty to a false statement claim. You know, mostly that person is going to get probation. But here, I think he has so stepped in it that it is very possible he's going to do someplace within the sentencing guidelines number of months, which is, you know, up to 6. Judge could even go above that, but I don't think so. I think it's enough of a statement for the judge just to make him serve some time when normally he would not have.
So there's the lesson, kids. Don't be like Mike Flynn. Be like Rick Gates. Or actually, maybe don't be like any of these people. There's much more to talk about, but I think that's a good place to leave it. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Josh.
We'll have another Left, Right, and Center episode for you on Friday. We'll talk more about impeachment. And also, 7 of the Democratic presidential candidates will appear at a debate in Los Angeles on Thursday. So we'll definitely be talking about that. To get that episode, make sure you're subscribed to Left, Right, and Center on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts. And as for this show, we're taking a little bit of a break just because the next 2 Wednesdays are Christmas and New Year's. So our next show will be on January 8th. I'm sorry if you're going to miss us over the holidays, but we'll be back soon. And if you have any questions in the meantime about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail. And in fact, we have a new phone number for the voicemail. It's 424-538-8888. It's like we're like a home window blinds company. It's 424-538-8888. If anyone wants to write us a jingle, please get in touch. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back with more All the President's Lawyers.